welcome back to Hallowed Histories with another ghost story for Christmas. And this week it's the turn of me, Richard Shepherd. I'm a podcaster, a writer, an academic, and today I'm going to be reading my story, The Cathedral House Portrait, my tribute to M.R. James, a good yarn, and a Christmas ghost story. The Cathedral House Portrait by Richard Shepherd. It was late in the evening, and most of the other wedding guests had left. Being unattached and staying at a cottage nearby the venue, I was in no such hurry. Besides, we'd reached that point in the evening where ties could be loosened and whiskies procured with no fear of rebuke from the more conservative guests. And it was in this state of sleepy, good-natured exhaustion that I found myself falling into conversation with the most unusual fellow. I'd found a lounge in the roomy old hotel where the reception had taken place, and after helping myself to a bottle of rather passable single malt from the open bar, had endeavoured to make myself as comfortable as possible. It was in this nesting stage, after stirring up the fire and selecting the best of the worn Chesterfield armchairs, that I realised I was not alone. The flames of the fires revealed another man sitting in the corner of the room, another wedding guest judging by his evening wear, and so it was to him that I raised my glass. "I say, old man, won't you join me? I brought another glass just in case," I said. The other man didn't speak for a while, and I wondered if I had offended him. Some of the bride's people were Plymouth Brethren, and I knew that they drew a hard line on spirits. Instead, after a long pause, the man smiled a rather thin smile and produced a glass of his own from the shadows by his side. "I've already got a glass of sherry," he said, "but I wouldn't mind some company in here. This place is rather gloomy." "Oldest hotel in the country, or so the chappie at the reception desk told me. Explains the plumbing, I suppose," I replied, waving the other man to the matching armchair that flanked the fire. As he settled himself in, I took a moment to study him. He looked to be from the bride's side, who I understood to be a blend of academic and civil service types. His face was thin, with hard lines etched around either side of the mouth, and he wore thick, round spectacles which reflected the firelight to such an extent that I couldn't see his eyes. The effect was a little unnerving, and I speculated that he might be a deputy headmaster with a reputation for sternness and foul humour amongst his pupils. When he spoke to me again, though, his voice was soft, with a touch of an accent that I couldn't quite place. "Yes, and everything that comes along with it, I suppose," he said. "How do you mean?" I asked. With the fire roaring and my glass full, I was happy as a tick in a mattress, but my new companion seemed uneasy. I felt a brief stir of distress that he might want to burden me with some personal nonsense. This was hardly the time or place for that at a wedding, you know. "Well, the older a place, the more history. This place has been standing for centuries, must have seen so much," my new companion said and took a sip of his sherry. "Quite so," I said, with what I hoped was my most sage expression, although personally I'm not one for dwelling on the past. "Sorry, I suppose I should have explained. History is sort of my line, or rather art history." "Oh, pictures and that," I said, staring into the fire. My companion gave me a dry smile, but did not seem deterred. Yes, pictures and that. I used to work for the office of the surveyor for the Queen's Pictures. Had to jack it all in a few years ago, though. Been on leave ever since. It's my nerves, you see," the man said. The flames leaped in the reflection of his glasses, making him look a trifle devilish. "Oh, nothing too serious, I hope." I privately wondered what in the world could have spooked a chap whose job it was to look at pictures of horses and landscapes all day. It sounded like a cushy number to me. "I had a bit of a fright on my last job, and I really haven't been able to focus on much since, to be perfectly frank. I say, I'm not boring you, am I?" my companion asked. "Not at all, old chap. You fancy talking about it? Maybe it'll help." "Oh God, I wish something would," he said, and took a long, deep swig of his sherry. "But please, if you're going to spin a little yarn, at least call me Bill, would you? And you are?" I asked. I didn't mind if the chap wanted to talk. It was after midnight and I was hovering on the edge of fatigue. But maybe his story would keep me awake long enough to finish the whiskey and watch the fire die down. "My name is Frank Carmichael," the man said, and then began his story. Chapter 2. You might think my job is rather a soft sort of thing, a matter of cataloguing, displaying, and occasionally restoring paintings. But there's rather a lot more to it than that. It's more in the line of detective work, really. You see, the royal family are not only one of the biggest landowners in the country, but they also own more art than any other institution or individual. Unfortunately, the pieces that they buy or are donated to them, or they receive in lieu of God knows what, have never been properly recorded. You see, there are pictures hanging in private homes all over the country that may be more rightly displayed in Balmoral or Sandringham, but were lent out centuries ago as a favour to cover some debt. There are even rumours that a certain Georgian monarch would swap paintings for a noble's wife, the way boys swap tobacco cards. It's only in the last 50 years or so that the Office of the Surveyors of the Queen's Paintings have made a concerted effort to catalogue every painting of royal provenance. It's tricky work, as you can imagine, and I spend most of my time chasing up old wills, old auction house catalogues, and inventorying the collections of thousands of stately homes in the country. It's detective work, you see. It was following these rather dusty leads that brought me up to this part of the world a few years ago. I had been invited by the dean of a local theological college, who had recently taken the post up, and wishing to make some modernizations to his house, had wanted to know if the paintings therein could be sold. Now, this may sound a little mercenary to you, and I admit it sounded a little cold-blooded to me too, but the dean was a young man, and had fallen under the spell of Gutierrez's The Theology of Liberation, and he wished to raise a little money to modernize the college, and have enough over to send a little way to the poor of South America. Now, please don't mistake me, I don't think he was a Marxist, but he wasn't quite what the small East Anglian town where he lived had in mind when they thought of a dean of college. The college itself was a compact sort of place consisting of a walled close inside the town itself. The walls were the oldest part, dating back to the 11th century, when the Normans had made it the first proper trading point between the North Sea coast and Norwich. These walls were thickened and napped flint, over 10 feet high with an arch gate at each corner to allow access. Inside these walls was a half square mile of land, on which stood a small chapel, a dormitory shared by the students and masters, and the dean's house, a handsome, spacious building made of the same flint as the walls, but with a peaked slate roof housing a row of garret windows. It was the largest building on the campus, mainly due to it housing the classrooms where the 70-odd students were taught by a staff of a dozen masters. Overall, it seemed a charming, quaint sort of place, particularly in the late autumn afternoon in which I had arrived. I had taken the train up from Cambridge, and after a few long waits for connections on those peculiar, lonely stations that litter the Norfolk Broads, I had been met by the dean at my destination, and we walked to his house together. "It's called the Cathedral House. Don't ask me why," the dean had said as he carried my bags up to the garret room where I'd be staying. "The nearest cathedral is 30 miles away." "How odd," I agreed. "Perhaps a bishop retired here and maybe founded the place." "Oh, nothing like that, I'm afraid. Are you interested in local history?" No, we've never had a bishop stay here, but a few characters have passed through," the dean said. He was a very personable chap, not the sort of rabble-rousing radical I anticipated. He was about 30, round-faced, with a receding crown of tufted blonde hair. He had an excessive energy, or maybe zeal, that was probably a prerequisite in a young cleric. "Oh," I said. I wasn't particularly interested in local gossip and history, and was more focused on the Spartan single room I'd been assigned. Still, the gas fire warmed the place up quickly, and the charming view over the green that separated the house from the dormitories and the chapel made up for the lack of furniture. The only art on the wall was a cheap framed print of Holman Hunt's The Light of the World, which may have quelled the more conservative doubts some townsfolk may have had over the young dean's apparent radicalism. I had taken the opportunity on our way up the stairs to conduct a preliminary review of the other paintings I had seen, which was overall not a bad lot, but not much value to them, and unlikely to have been part of any royal collection. Overall, it looked like another wasted trip. As I watched out of the window of my room, I saw an elderly woman brandishing a large umbrella despite the clear skies. She was making her way through the fallen leaves that littered the green to a bench under a spreading yew tree. "Is that a housekeeper?" I asked. The dean placed my luggage on the bed with a creak and joined me at the narrow window. "Oh no, that's Mrs. Spaulding. She lives in town," the dean said, with what sounded like exasperation in his voice. "Oh, she has access to campus?" I asked. "They all do. The gates are only shut between dusk and dawn. Until then, the townsfolk have always had free rein to walk across campus. Inevitable, really. I mean, we are in the middle of town." "It's not a distraction?" I asked. "Oh, hardly at all. The town is a small one, and we like to keep on good terms with them. And we're not exactly a monastery here, you know. In the world, but not of it, and all that, the dean said, and left me to get settled in. I was to have free run of the house after 3 o'clock, when the lessons were ended. I was eager to make a start that day and finish as soon as I could. Now, it may have been that I was in unfamiliar surroundings, but I felt a distinct uneasiness wandering through Cathedral House. There was a faint odour to the place, a little like turpentine, which you can easily assume I was familiar with, and a little like stagnant water. The combination wasn't a pleasant one, and seemed to grow in strength on the ground floor. To the left of the entrance, a door was locked, which was the only one I encountered at Cathedral House, and it was from under this door that the smell seemed to emanate the strongest. I resolved to ask my host at dinner for a key to the door, as well as politely inquiring as to whether the drains were of the most efficient sort around the campus, as the smell was truly off-putting. I wandered round outside Cathedral House to see if I could peer through the window into the locked room, but it was too dark to see anything inside. There was a suggestion of large, heavy forms, like furniture covered up with thick shrouds, and a dull shine to the walls that suggested wood panelling. As I peered further, I could make out a picture on the wall opposite, so large it seemed to run the height of the room itself. There was an indication of an oval that might have been a face nearer the top, suggesting a portrait, the first one I had seen at Cathedral House. For the first time, my professional interest had been piqued, and I pulled myself away from the window, with a resolve to get into that room redoubled. As I made my way back into the house, I saw that my investigation had not gone unnoticed. Mrs. Spaulding, the woman the dean had remarked upon, was staring from across the green. However, whether the expression on her face, a rictus of barely concealed fear and distaste, was aimed at me, or the dark, heavy windows that looked out from the locked room, it was too far away to tell. That night I'd been invited to dine with the dean and a few of the other senior masters. The South American influence that had asserted itself on the dean had spread to the rest of his household, and we dined on venison in a thick mahogany-brown sauce that I understood was called mole. It was tasty enough, although a little overspiced for my tastes. The senior masters evidently agreed, and after a few mouthfuls pushed the food around their plates as if movement could make it more palatable. To distract themselves, and in the tradition of academics everywhere, they turned to gossip. The three senior masters began to dissect the characters of a few students who had excelled in stupidity or laziness, and over dessert began to turn their scrutiny on their fellow masters. The dean himself kept an admirable distance from this, asking me questions about my profession and the rather sad collection of paintings in his care. I assured him that my office had no belief that any of the paintings had any royal provenance, and were his to sell or do whatever they liked with, as he pleased. With that out of the way, the business, as it were, I asked my host about the locked room at the front of the house. He smiled at me, as if he were used to answering this question, but did not answer until the dishes were cleared away and the housekeeper was out of the room. "I'm afraid there's no great mystery there. It's just a disused room. We'll throw a few sticks of furniture in there if they're not needed elsewhere, but it's no good for a classroom. I can't use it as an office either. I tried when I first came here." The room is, I said, groping for the right word. Uncomfortable? It's cold. Something to do with the exposure. It never catches the sun. Thick glass don't let in the light, as our gardener has said. Did you meet Giles? He keeps the green looking green, lives in the town. But he won't even tend the flower beds outside that room. He's superstitious, you see. Green thumb, though. Place would look a poor sight without him, the dean said. He was quiet again until the housekeeper had brought the pudding in. I was glad to see it was a very distinctly English spotted dick, with a steaming jug of custard. When the housekeeper left, I ventured another question. "He refuses to plant flowers out there because the room is cold," I asked. "Ha! No, not likely. No, he doesn't like the feeling of being watched. An old Jack can see him in there," the dean said as he tucked his spoon into his pudding. "Old Jack?" a voice said from the other end of the table. He was a new master who had only been with the college for a few days. We had been introduced, and I seem to remember his name was Harcourt. "Yes, old Jack. It's a gloomy old portrait that hangs in the room. His best place for it is an abandoned room. It's a horrible old thing. And before you get any ideas about pinching it back for a Royal Highness, its provenance is impeccable. You see, it's a self-portrait, commissioned, composed, sat for, and framed by Dean John Scroop about 400 years ago. I see, and John Scroop is old Jack? Harcourt asked the Dean. He was the youngest man at the table, and looked around as if he might be collectively pulling his leg. They're the very same. You see, not all of my predecessors as deans were as charming as me, the Dean said with a smile, drawing a chuckle from his colleagues, and John Scroop was one of the worst. 400 years ago? Was he a heretic? There's plenty of them around then. Maybe he was a spy for the Spanish? Harcourt asked. Well, heretic gets near the matter, but doesn't quite nail old Jack. It's more accurate to say that nobody really knew what he was. His predecessor was a thoroughly decent chap who had kept his position for an unprecedented 70 years and had amassed one of the best libraries in the country by the time of his death. It was believed that it was this collection of books that attracted John Scroop to our college, and when he managed to save some minor member of the aristocracy in a skirmish with the French, he was invited to pick his own reward, so as he chose to become our dean. But by all accounts, he was an odd sort, and prior to being a mercenary, not much is known about him. As his portrait suggests, he had a massive red wiry hair that covered most of his face, with extravagant masses of sideburns, moustaches and eyebrows. Must have looked like a true terror to the masters and the townsfolk back then. I should say so, one of the masters interjected. But why has he got such a bad reputation? Well, as I said, he was apparently attracted to the place because of the library, which he supplemented with crates of books, folios and incunabula of his own that he picked up during his travels with the army. Other than the library, he had no interest in the running of the college, and turfed the masters out of the cathedral house into the dormitories with the boys. Apparently they didn't need much persuading. The noises coming from Scroop's rooms were rather hair-raising. Some thought he was troubled by his past and was fighting the battles against the Spaniards and the Frenchies in his mind over and over again. Others hinted about the documents that he brought with him to supplement the old dean's library, which weren't written in any language the masters recognised, and with illustrations that would have made a Webster or Kidd blush to put it on the stage. The Dean was obviously enjoying telling the story, and had begun to get the impression that he fancied himself as something of a raconteur. But I always fancied myself as something of a polite listener, so I didn't grumble. "Now, what kind of things was he into?" Harcourt said, who I fancy a little more than the usual share of morbid curiosity. "Oh, he's obsessed with the usual ephemera that the church throws off like exhaust fumes. Imps and demons, raw heads and bloody bones. But the peculiar thing was that Dean John Scroop wasn't ashamed of these rather frivolous pursuits, but would speak of characters like Baal and Moloch in the same breath as John the Baptist or King Saul." Now, these days, we know demons and devils as being more metaphorical in nature. They represent punishments for falling away from one's faith or temptations towards taking shortcuts. But John Scroop, however, when he did deign to teach the scholars, was more likely to discuss the hierarchy of the princes of hell rather than the Gospels, and it was a brave scholar who lasted until the end of one of those lectures. Those that did stay to the bitter end hinted darkly at a practical element to his lectures, and that's when the nickname Old Jack stuck. "I say, how do you know so much about this?" Mr. Harcourt asked. "Oh, it's kind of a tradition, I think. My predecessor told me the story, and I'll bore my replacement with it one day, too. My predecessor had a bit of a head start, however. He was a local history buff, and made it a point to pore through all the documents he could find about Old Jack, including the court documents." "Oh, court," I said. "So Old Jack ran afoul of the law eventually." "Oh, yes, although the evidence was rather sketchy as far as my predecessor could tell. But this was around the time of the East Anglian witch panic, Matthew Hopkins and all that. And accusations were sometimes enough to put a chap to the question. And there were certainly plenty of accusations. You see, around the time that the masters were put out of Cathedral House, the townsfolk began to notice their dogs going missing, sometimes as many as three in a week, more if the moon was full. At first it seemed like a coincidence, but by the bleak winter of 1681, there were no hounds left at all. Now, around this time, the noises increased in Cathedral House, and lanterns burnt in Scroop's study's windows until the early hours. Then, near the end of winter, children started to go missing. the Dean said and looked troubled, as if he regretted starting this story. The other men around the table shifted awkwardly in their seats, as if the pleasant diversion of gossip, even if it was 400 years old, had taken a turn they had not expected. And yet they did not ask him to stop. One child at first, the daughter of a local blacksmith. She was sent to bed and in the morning had vanished. The townsfolk sent out a search party, thinking she might have got herself in the boggy rivers that make up much of this part of the world, but they never found her out in the broads. When the first day of the search was over, the townsfolk asked the young scholars of the college for their help in broadening the search area. Old Jack was begrudging, but eventually let the boys join in. It was to no avail, however, and the blacksmith and his wife were eventually left alone to the grief of an unfathomable loss. However, within a matter of a fortnight, they were not the only family missing a child. We were now passing around a bottle of port, although the Dean spent more time cradling his glass and looking at the dark liquid reflect in the firelight than drinking it. "Great Scott," I said, "what happened?" "The same as before, I'm sorry to say. It was a scrivener's son this time, who again disappeared from an attic bedroom. All the doors had been locked and bolted, as all doors had been after the girl had gone missing, and yet the boy simply vanished. There was a small round window in the attic that he conceivably could have gone through, yet it was a drop of some 20 feet to the ground, and there were no indentations of a ladder in the hard snow that hadn't melted away yet. The search after that was a little more thorough, and there were attempts made to dredge the broads and nearby lakes. Houses in the poor areas were searched, although the poor themselves maintained that the searchers would have more luck focusing on the college, and the new dean, who seemed so reluctant to lend his help to the search, and so indifferent as to the fate of the children. After that, the dean was silent for a long time, and I wondered if that was the end of the story. "The third disappearance was rather worse," the dean said eventually, his voice very quiet in the dining room. "A local woman, a local beauty by all accounts, had given birth to triplets earlier that year. They were strong, healthy, and by all accounts well cared for by the woman and her husband, a sailor who was away from home for long stretches. And she was inconsolable when, after one night, when a particularly bright full moon filled the sky, each one of her babies were plucked from their crib. She demanded something be done, and had heard the tales of the townsfolk who had lost faith in the new dean. She heard how they had grown suspicious of the blaspheming of John Scroope's obsession with the shadowed sides of faith and his increasingly nocturnal habits. So, walking through the town, she gathered a group of townsfolk behind her, a mob, I suppose we would call it, growing larger and larger as her destination became known. By the time they had reached the upper gate of the college, some 200 men, women, and children had gathered behind her and listened to her as she began her harangue. And she began by accusing old Jack of all sorts of crimes, primarily being the force behind the disappearances for purposes of necromancy. She reminded the crowd how in nearby villages men and women had been accused of using the body parts of children in their spells, how the rendered fat of a girl child could be used to rub on the body and by doing so allow a witch to fly, or how the finger bone of a boy child, when properly stripped of flesh and with the right arcane symbols on it, could turn that bone into a key capable of unlocking any door. "I say, how did old Jack like that?" Harcourt asked. "Not much. But the woman soon turned her scorn on the masters and scholars of the college, accusing them of complicity in the crimes and of turning a noble and holy place into a house of devils and warlocks. The masters and scholars filed out onto the college green after threats of putting the dormitories to fire had been made. They must have been terrified facing the increasingly violent and angry mob, and more terrified still when their bereaved mother gave them an ultimatum. You see, she believed that the only way the staff and boys could prove their innocence and godly nature was to see the punishment of old Jack himself, not suffering a witch to live and all that. So they were given a choice. Well, not much of a choice, really. Of either dragging old Jack out and dealing with him, or seeing the college itself burnt to the ground, and then themselves strung up by the nearby yew trees. A few of the older masters, seeing which way the weather was turning, plucked up their courage and entered the cathedral house. They later said that they found old Jack in his study, the same room we now keep locked, working on the portrait that still hangs in there. He was surrounded by enough evidence, although the masters would never say what that entailed, to convince them of his guilt, and the men dragged the howling, cursing Dean out to meet his fate. "What did they do?" Harcourt asked. For all his youth and bumptiousness, he sounded almost breathless. "Oh, well, they killed him, of course. The mob formed half a circle, and the scholars another half, with old Jack at the centre. Every time he tried to escape the circle, he would be shoved back or kicked or beaten with branches ripped off the old yews. You can imagine the townsfolk didn't treat him kindly, but the scholars were even worse. They knew that if they let old Jack slip through, it would mean their own lives as forfeit, you see. So every time old Jack tried to break the line of scholars, they were particularly vicious in repelling him. It was said that as old Jack grew more bloodied and weary, the scholars grew more intense. And as the circle grew smaller, sensing blood, I suppose, it was the scholars who took the lead in tearing old Jack limb from limb, and finally, his head from its trunk." I could hear a few of the masters murmur under their breath in horror, and the Dean himself seemed to regret the telling. So, with some eagerness, he bustled his guests away to the door. They were a subdued bunch. I didn't envy them the long, unlit walk back across the common, where old Jack had met his gruesome end 400 years ago. When they had all left, it was only the Dean, myself, and the dying embers of the fire in the hearth. "Would you like to see the portrait?" the Dean asked, after what seemed like an eternity. "Of course," I said, and finished my drink with more enthusiasm than I felt. The Dean got up and I followed him out of the dining room. The corridor outside was dark, and my host explained that he didn't like to keep too many lights running unless he had to. I suppose the money he saved went to the South American poor, but such charity did little for my peace of mind as I followed him down the gloomy corridor. Eventually we stopped by the front door, to which the locked room just lay to the right. I couldn't help but imagine the terrified scholars manhandling their dean out of the room and delivering him to the mob outside. I looked at the current dean before me, fumbling for the right keys, but his own face was hidden by shadows. I wondered, with the sadness and fear that only a lonely man could feel, whether this whole thing was an elaborate joke at my expense, and the masters who I thought had left had hidden themselves in the room, ready to jump out and frighten me. "Do you smell that?" I asked the Dean, just to break the silence. He turned to me, just as the key turned in the lock, and sniffed a little. "Maybe, something faint, is it chemicals of some sort? Maybe grease? It's an odd sort of reek. Probably some sort of cleaning gunk the housekeeper uses. Shall we go in?" I nodded, and the Dean slowly eased open the heavy wooden door. Inside, the room was lit by moonlight streaming in through those thick windows, throwing the dust cloths that had been thrown over the furniture into monochrome deserts of shadow and stark white. The room was spacious and would have been most suited to the offices of a dean, offering an unobstructed view of both the chapels and the dormitories, as well as the green that separated the buildings. The smell, however, would have put anyone off staying too long inside, and I wondered that the new dean had seen fit to call it a faint odour. I agreed with the description, though. It was something between fat poured down a drain that had started to render, and the stink of white spirit and gesso that I knew from the restoration room back at the office. What dominated the space, as I should have expected, was the portrait I had glimpsed through the window earlier. A wide shaft of moonlight lit up the whole frame as well as any spotlight in the gallery, and every detail was available to the naked eye. The frame was beautiful in that baroque heavy style that I knew would look a deep, rich gold in the daylight. As to the painting, I had expected a rigid, formal portrait in the court style of the time, the Hans Holbein sort of thing. I was instead reminded most of all of Rembrandt's painting, The Anatomy Lesson of Dr. Nicholas Tulp, which is a rather grisly study of an anatomist leading his class in the dissection of a ghastly-looking pale corpse. Rembrandt used the lights of the faces and the body to illuminate the scene, with no background except for unrelenting black. I could certainly see the influence of the Dutch masters on this self-portrait, with long brush strokes and vivid colour splashes around the rough collars and lacy cuffs of the outfit old Jack wore. The real colour was in his hair, though, which was of such a vivid and wild red that it looked fresh painted, and I marvelled that even in the washed-out monochrome of moonlight it could look so vivid. The only other colours came from the palette that he held in one hand, which was an odd sort of affectation that was presumably added to remind the viewer that the subject was also the artist. His other hand was at his belt, and seemed curled around the handle of a dagger or a knife. With no background except for black, and after the eye had been caught by the bright slashes of colour in the subject's outfits and hair, there was nowhere else to look at but the face of old Jack, and it was here that the true horror of the piece was revealed. I had never seen such a portrait that gave such vivid life to a subject before, not once. And I wondered if old Jack's talents had extended to some primitive form of photography, for each detail of his face was rendered with such subtlety and detail that I could almost believe I was looking at a real person. And what a face it was! The vivid red hair I have already mentioned, but it crowned a face with a look of such cruelty and disdain for the world that I felt the hairs rise on my forearms. Old Jack's face was hard and square, and I could certainly see him more as a war-hardened mercenary than the dean of a theological school. Scars ran across his cheeks in crisscross patterns, probably one in some sabre fight, and one eye was twisted into a red, angry-looking swirl of scar tissue. I dared not speculate how it had been lost, and how hard old Jack must have fought against the mob that eventually tore him to shreds. "Well, you can see why I wouldn't want this chap breathing down my neck in the office, eh?" the dean said. I had forgotten he was there, and the sudden sound of his voice after my prolonged study of the portrait made me gasp. As I did so, I noticed a curious thing. The room was cold, yes, but the breath of air, I gasped, was visible as a plume of white mist, as if the dean and I had been outside on a very cold evening. Oddly, the dean himself was not affected, and I wanted to ask him why not, for the cold that had illuminated my breath I now felt all over my entire body. The moisture on my eyes froze in a painful tightening, and my skin shivered in great spasms that racked my entire body. I looked for the doorway heading back to the corridor, thinking I could warm myself by the fire, but the joints creaked in my neck and popped like icicles falling from a windowsill. I still don't know why the dean didn't suffer the same burning cold I did, but he obviously did recognize my distress, and he stepped towards me, his plain round face full of concern, and he was close enough to catch me when I collapsed after feeling the light touch of a long, scrawny finger run a path from between my shoulder blades up to the soft skin from the base of my skull, a finger coming from the portrait behind me. Chapter 3. Carmichael eased himself back into his chair, and I thought his rather strange story to be finished. Certainly the whiskey I had been drinking was finished, and the fire had almost died in the hearth. The one tiny window showed only darkness and a few fat flakes of snow blown about by the rising winds. I hoped Carmichael felt better for the telling of his odd story, although he still looked jumpy to me, and kept on casting glances into the rapidly growing shadows at the corner of the room. "So what do you make of that?" Frank Carmichael asked. "Overwork, perhaps? A gas leak? You mentioned an odd sort of stink." I thought the same when I woke up the next morning, and I tried to keep telling myself that when I was leaving in the afternoon. The dean had called my office, and they recommended a leave of absence. Naturally, I don't remember. But after I fainted, apparently I started to mumble all sorts of things. Languages I'd never learned. Languages that died out centuries ago. Rhymes, prayers, all sorts of odd things. It made the dean look a little askance at me the next day, so it must have been pretty hairy stuff. "So will you go back? Not to the college, I mean. That seems like a bad idea. But to your job?" Carmichael smiled a sick sort of smile and reached inside his jacket pocket. He pulled out a piece of paper and handed it to me. It was a letter addressed to one Francis Carmichael. "I am sure they would take me back, there's no worries there. However, this arrived from one of the chaps in the office the other day. He's an old chum of mine. Read it, please." So, in the weakening light, I did. And the letter was pleasant to begin with, albeit a little dull about office gossip and shop talk that any two colleagues might be forgiven for. It was towards the end of the letter that I started to wonder a little. I'll try my best to repeat as closely as I can what Carmichael's colleague said before, with our mutual consent, we burned the letter on the embers of the fire. The letter read thusly. "I hope it doesn't stir you up too much to mention the Cathedral House, but I know you're always a stickler for the tying of loose ends no matter what. So I thought you should be aware that the job you were sent to do was completed by yours truly. 3 months after you flew the coop, in a matter of speaking, the head of office asked me to go down and see if you had turned up anything. You were still a little raw back then, so we didn't trouble you with any questions. And the whole thing was done easily. As you know yourself, none of the paintings fell under our purview. I was glad to get out of the place, to be perfectly honest. Not only was it a waste of time in terms of our work, but the atmosphere was perfectly grim. The old dean you mentioned left about a month after you did. A midnight flit without a word to anyone. Rumour is he fled to Chile to meet up with some of the radical Christian lot, who like their prayers with little gunfire. The new dean, his replacement, is awful. A foul-tempered old boy who all the masters and scholars are terrified of, and he made me sleep in the dorms like a bloody child. I had one interview with him in his office, the prickly ginger bugger. But he didn't care one whit why I was there, and even laughed when I told him you were on leave for a case of the nerves. No wonder someone saw fit to put his eye out. And I tell you, the eye patch made him look like a bloody pirate than a dean. Sorry, I'm getting overexcited here. The chap really did rub me up the wrong way. I should try and be a little more Christian, I know, and see things from his perspective. I mean, he must have had a hard go of it in his first few months of the job. You see, a few of the local children had gone missing, so he probably had police and journalists crawling over the place, when all he wanted was a bit of privacy to teach and study his rather impressive collection of books. Still, it would only have taken us an extra second to be polite, as my mother would have said. So, Frank, I'll bid you farewell now. And please come back soon, if only to give me some intelligent conversation around the office. Best regards, Arthur Masterson. P.S. I know I said I'd lay off the awful dean. The thing that really got my goat was his office contains a rather interesting piece of art. It's a big old thing, 6 foot high by 3 foot wide, painted absolutely black, presumably in the style of Malevich. I know you hate that modern stuff, and most of it is tripe. This had to be seen to be believed. I thought this mini might care for art and we could have some common ground, but no luck. Beastly chap. You might like the frame, though. Looked a good 400 years old. Very ornate. Much more your cup of tea. The Hallett Histories podcast was hosted by me, Richard Shepherd, and produced and recorded at the UEA's Media Suite. Find out more about us at hallett-histories.org or write to us at hallethistories@gmail.com. Also, why not check out our YouTube channel and our social media on Instagram. Thank you very much for listening.